The information presented on this show is solely for informational purposes and is not to be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any financial product or service mentioned. Waddell & Reed Incorporated is a registered broker-dealer and federally registered investment advisor. Any opinions expressed are those of Rick Theobald and are subject to change based on market and other conditions. Waddell & Reed does not offer tax or legal advice. Please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decisions.
Hello and welcome to Perspectives. Today we're talking about personal finance and financial literacy. If understanding your options when it comes to taking out student loans or saving for retirement leaves you feeling confused, you're not alone. A study out of George Washington University and the University of Pennsylvania shows only about a third of survey respondents could correctly answer three finance questions involving compounding interest, inflation, and diversification. We'll be talking about that and more today on our show, and we'll be taking your calls. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so by calling 414-1234 or 1-800-926-8809 if you're outside the Tallahassee area. You can also reach us on email at perspectives@wfsu.org or find us on Twitter at WFSUPerspective. So we're joined in the studio today by Rick Theobald. He's a financial advisor with Waddell & Reed, David Bidell, a CPA with Bidell & Company, and Matt Hall, a pastor at Canopy Roads Baptist Church. Thank you guys all for being here today.
It's good to be here, right?
Great to be here.
So right at the beginning of the show, we talked a little bit about money being this taboo subject that, people are a little hesitant to talk about. And it got me wondering, how that impacts the way that people approach their finances. And I was wondering, are you guys seeing that impact? People not talking about money, and is it impacting the way they spend or the way they save? Rick, any thoughts on that generally?
Well, Regan, every time I meet with a couple of clients, usually a husband and a wife, we find out, much to their surprise, that they think very differently about money, and that's one of the reasons why they don't talk about it. And correspondingly, it's probably why they came in to see us, is they need someone to be able to get them on the same page. Very often you'll find that when men and women are talking about money, one of the major motivators we run into is that there's a security component, there's an insecurity component, and then there's that we don't talk about it because we don't know what the other one thinks, and they don't have a safe place to be able to develop that kind of conversation. So yeah, we see that a lot. And I think it's one of the reasons why my practice were very successful is because we can get clients to talk to each other and agree on what their values are, focus on those values, and then they can achieve their goals.
Mm-hmm. Matt, what about you? I was thinking that in terms of, I'm sure that you meet with people a lot who are maybe having a struggle in their relationship. And I've always heard people say that money is one of the biggest reasons for conflict in a relationship. Is that something that you deal with and that you try to help people work with, is how to talk to each other about money?
Oh, it's a very common conflict source in marriage. Dave Ramsey says it's the number one cause of divorce. Of course, he's trying to sell his product. But it may not be number one, but it's definitely high on the list. People disagree about how to use money, and Rick is definitely right. They come to marriage just assuming that, we have money, we'll have plenty of money, and we just spend it. And one's a spender, one's a saver, one's a management geek, and the other one is a free spirit. And you bringing those two together creates conflict because they argue about how to use the money. Mm-hmm. And when they get in financial problems, one is I told you so, and the other is, well, you let me do this. So it's a source of conflict.
What do you recommend for people? I mean, how do people with these two different maybe spending and saving philosophies find a common ground?
Well, they need to find a goal of what they're trying to accomplish. So, we would help them sit down and develop a budget, a spending plan, because you don't have unlimited resources. And even if you did, spending it all on yourself is not necessarily the way to happiness or the way to find most significance in life. You know, accumulation is not the only goal in life. So we would try to get them to sit down and develop a financial plan. You know, what are your goals in life? You know, how does that involve saving, giving, spending, and how do you manage your spending in order to accomplish those goals? So you need to set a vision for the future that you can agree about. And then when you agree on the plan to get there, then you're fighting with the plan, not each other. Mm-hmm. So it's not your spouse's or your boyfriend or girlfriend or significant other's fault. It's, we agreed to this plan, so now we're managing the plan.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that's something I've heard, you mentioned Dave Ramsey says, money is one of the leading causes of divorce. I have a friend who recently got married, and I know that she did some marriage counseling before she got married or couples counseling before she got married, as a standard practice that a lot of people do before marriage. And part of that involved talking about money and how they thought they would handle money in their marriage. Is that something, you recommend?
As a matter of fact, none of our staff will perform a wedding without premarital mentoring. We call it mentoring. We pair them with a mentor couple, that is a couple who has been married for a long time and has a successful marriage. It doesn't mean that they've never had problems. In fact, they probably had problems and they've navigated through that. But yes, and one of the things we do in the course of that mentoring is we talk about a whole variety of subjects, and one of those is finances, and try to help them to talk about things they might not have talked about in their dating time together. So, we bring up topics. We actually ask them to fill out an online survey of questions separately and then come together, and there'll be areas of disagreement about, whether you should save or whether both should work or have, one checking account or all those kinds of things. And we have an opportunity to talk about it together with a mentor couple. We're not necessarily telling them this is how to live your life, but to help them have a conversation about that so that there's some source of agreement.
Mm-hmm. And that makes me think about financial literacy. So, we're saying people don't really talk about finances a lot. They are sort of shy away from it. You can even enter into a marriage and not have really discussed what their spending and saving philosophies are. And I wonder if some of that comes from a lack of financial literacy. People don't really have the tools to talk about this. Is that something that you see in your work, David, where maybe there's just sort of a lack of general understanding about finances and how money works?
I don't know if there's necessarily a lack of understanding. I think there's a lack of coordination. And I think that both Rick and I both think that we can help a couple or a person reach whatever their specific desires are in that regard. I don't know if people don't come see me who really don't have already some interest in trying to expand their knowledge of what and how they're trying to do something. It's not, I don't really see very many people who don't have any literacy knowledge. However, the SCPA has been very instrumental in trying to push the American public into more knowledge of what American literacy is. They have that little pig that they have commercials for. They're trying to get everybody to save some money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Feed the pig first.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I was going to say that's a sort of a philosophy that I've heard before. I think my dad says that. The pay yourself first idea, which I think is kind of. An interesting concept when, we're talking about all kinds of different ways to save or to protect your finances. Why is that? Why do you say, feed the pig first, pay yourself first?
Well, if you don't pay yourself first, nobody else is going to. One of the things, though, that people have a preconceived notion about what their financial life is going to look like, especially when they get interested in it. About the time they get their first paycheck and watch the taxes go out, and they say, what happened? But what you have is people, for instance, everybody here knows what a house looks like, right?
Right.
But everybody's house picture is not the same. So when you have specifically when you're a child, you have a picture of what a house looks like, and then you have a picture of what your dream house looks like. And that metamorphosizes over time. So once you get to the point where you say, I want my house to look like this, you start to save towards it. Now, we talked about the couples coming together, and each one of them has a blueprint in their head about what they think their house looks like. Yours, Regan, might be a two-story Tudor, got big columns out in front and a deck in the back and a lake. And then your significant other might be thinking, no, I want a ranch style. I want 5,000 square feet and lots of open grass. But until you talk about it, your blueprints don't match up. And so you start building your house, and your significant other starts building their house in their mind, and you end up with these mixed blueprints. So what do? Is the first thing is you come together and you plan what you want, like Matt was saying. You agree on a common vision. Once you do that, you have a blueprint that you start to save for. So actually, you don't even start to save first. You agree, what are we going to save, or what am I going to save? So then once you get to that point, you start to save. All right, save first, because if you go out and party first and pay for all the bills and everything, there will be no money left over, guaranteed, and that's why most of the country is living paycheck to paycheck. But as soon as you commit to doing the first 5%, 10%, 20%, and I can give you specific numbers later, but as soon as you decide that you're going to do the first 10% goes to savings, it becomes a priority to you. And we all know that our priorities are what we end up reaching. But you don't know what your priorities are until you actually look at your wallet, your checkbook, or your debit card. It's a very easy way to identify what someone's priorities are.
Right. Well, and I think that really speaks to the idea of budgeting, which I think sounds really simple. You know, I think anybody could say, well, of course you should have a budget. That's, you know, how you know how much you're spending on what your priorities are, whether you'd like to change those priorities to something else, and you know, what sort of spending room you have. But I think a lot of people find making a budget to be really overwhelming. They don't even know where to start. I don't know if you guys have experience with helping people make budgets or know about budgeting, but what would be sort of the first tip you would give to somebody who wants to start building a budget?
Well, from my perspective, the first thing that you can do is let's look at where you are spending your money. So the easiest way is just to do a spending diary. Record everything you spend. It sounds a little tedious, and it's a bit of a challenge, but everyone can do it. And if you write down everything that you spend and you put it in a category, you can do it in – it's like keeping a checkbook. You know, you just record the spending when you do it. After a month, you've got a default budget, and you know where you're spending it.
Great. We'll have more on that after this quick break. Welcome back to Perspectives. Today we're talking about personal finance, financial literacy. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so by giving us a call at 414-1234 or 1-800-926-8809. You can also send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org. So right before the break, we were starting to talk about just someone who wants to start getting a handle on their finances and maybe wants to start making a budget, which can seem a little overwhelming. Rick, you were talking about the idea of creating a spending diary where you write down everything that you buy over a given period of time and lump it into categories. And then, David, you mentioned during the break, another way somebody could approach that is just by, you know, using their bank account to show them that.
You can take your bank statement for the last whatever period you want to use, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and make the allocation out. And then obviously you need to pick up any other monies the way you spend it. Some people have an account that they spend money out of for a variety of things every year, and they don't account for every penny they do. But I think initially you need to know where you spend the money. I think Rick's right about that.
Mm-hmm. And
oh, go ahead.
I think Matt was saying about using credit cards. I think you also need to show that, how it breaks out and how it's spent as
right.
part of that.
Yeah, I think, one thing that I thought was interesting about the using your bank account idea to create this spending diary is I know that my bank account already kind of breaks those into categories for me. So maybe it makes it a little more approachable to somebody who thinks like, oh, gosh, this is going to be tough to do. My bank account has a little pie graph and it says, oh, you spent, 20% of your spending was for healthcare costs, or 13% of your spending was for transportation, which I think might help a little bit. But you had some reservations about the idea of just trusting your bank account too, Rick.
Well, the reason is because that's not truly a budget. All that is a default budget. When you record what you've been spending your money on, it just says that, okay, these are the habits that you have right now. The next step that you need to do on that is to evaluate, all right, am I happy where I'm spending my money? Is it actually representing what I profess my values to be, or where I want to go? So once you pull that out, you just take a look and say, oh my gosh, I hear this time and time again. I had no idea I spent so much. $1,200 on eating out? Really? That's the reason you don't have an IRA, is because you're eating it. So
that's when you start establishing goals for how you spend your money, how you want to spend your money. And I think goal acquisition is exactly what makes us all, I don't know about better people, but it certainly makes us all more
conscious spenders or savers.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's also goal achievement. I mean, people get an adrenaline rush. They get a brain chemical released when they actually make a goal. And that's one of the reasons why you have to celebrate making your goals. Budgeting sounds so just dry and hard, but what you really do is, if you change it around, I have a spending plan. I made my plan. I did it. I got to the end of this, and it worked. And now I have enough money to be able to take the vacation and have it not follow me home at the end of it.
Well, it's kind of like dieting in some respects. You know, one reason a lot of people have difficulty losing weight is because of ghost calories. Mm-hmm. They don't know where they're consuming the calories. You know, it's a handful of peanuts here. It's a bowl of ice cream at midnight or 10:30. You know, it's an extra piece of toast in the morning. And you add up those toasts. You may be keeping track of your big meals, your big three, but then it's those ghost calories that you're not keeping track of that adds up to 500 calories a day. And before long, you know, you put on 10 pounds and you're frustrated you can't get it off. It's because you don't know where it's going. And the same is true for your money. If you don't know where it's going, you can't tell it where it needs to go. So you'll be shocked at how much you're spending eating out, most people. It's just $7 here and $10 there, and I always eat fast food and it's cheap. And, you know, it adds up. You will be shocked. And that could be the difference in you accomplishing your goal, or at least beginning to accomplish your goal, is to tell your money where you want it to go instead of it just leaving and you wondering, well, where's all the money? And that's how you have fights. I remember when we were newlywed, my wife was keeping the checkbook, and she was home with the kids, and I was the sole provider, and I would get mad with her when I'd say, "There's no money here. Where did it all go?" And she'd say, "Here, you can see where it went." And we'd have this argument, but we didn't have a plan. You know, it was just leaving. It was coming in and leaving, and we weren't telling it ahead of time, this is what we want to spend it on. And when we started doing that, we had a happier marriage.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It looks like we've got a caller here on our line, so we'll go ahead and go to our phone lines here. And it looks like Wayne is on the line. He says his wife and he were married later in life, and they have separate accounts that they use for different expenses that they've accrued throughout their previous life. I'm wondering, do you guys think that is a good way to approach spending, to use separate accounts in your married life? Is that something maybe, Matt, that you've dealt with, people who use two different separate spending accounts?
Well, there are differences of opinion on this, Wayne. And I would say that it's a whole lot easier if you pool everything together and use that to spend, you plan your spending so that you don't decide, somebody's paying for the cable bill and I'm paying for the house payment and you're paying for the car payment. That just gets complicated. It's easier if you put it all in one account. Now, you can have separate savings accounts that you save for, and maybe if you have a business, a sideline business, you can have that separate. And for tax purposes, it might be easier to account for income and expenses with that. But with with your normal spending, your personal spending, it's easier if you have one account. You agree that this one account is going to handle everything, all of our spending. So it's easier to manage that way.
Mm-hmm. I think if you're going to establish a goal for a family unit, then they need to have both be reaching for that goal. And I think part of that is probably having some argument about why there is a separation and or why money's being spent for whatever it is. And some people are avoiding that confrontation right now, but I think eventually it will be a confrontation. So I think it's best to just take it head on and get over with.
I'm going to take the other side on this right now. Wayne is introduced to the most important thing was that he's married. And what's the goal? Well, let's just assume it's to stay married, right, Wayne? And in many cases, separate checking accounts is the way that many of the clients have managed to avoid the argument that comes along with spending money. Everything that Matt and David said is absolutely true. It is simpler. It's a lot better idea to go ahead and do that. And, you know, biblically, we want the two to become as one, et cetera. But it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a while to merge finances. So it's a little bit unclear, but they have separate accounts to deal with different expenses they've incurred. It could be they're keeping the account separate because they're debts that they accrued from previous life. So I just call this the bucket method. I got a bucket over here that's for fun. I got a bucket over here that's for vacation. I got a bucket over here that we share. And so once you agree on which bucket it's coming out of, sometimes separate accounts can save a marriage. I know that's true because my sister and brother-in-law told me that's true.
Well, that's a good, very interesting information. It looks like we're actually going to be able to bring Wayne in on our phone lines here.
Oh,
Wayne, thanks for joining us today. Welcome to Perspectives.
You're welcome. Thank you for letting me talk.
Hi, Wayne.
This is not quite like it was presented. We both had our own jobs. We both have grown children. And our spending habits, this has nothing to do with prior expenses. We pay monthly. We split the bills right down the middle every month. But her money is her money, and she wants to spend it on her kids, she can. And mine is mine. If I want to spend it on my kids, I can't. That eliminates any arguments over the spending of money when you both have your own incomes and can spend the money that way and just split expenses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it sounds like you've come to a agreement about how you want to split expenses. And their kids from two separate marriages, and that's very common in culture today. One of the things we find, though, is that when you set up a very clear division between who spends on what expense, that introduces walls in the marriage, though, is that, okay, well, the cable bill was more, and was it because we rented three movies last night, or et cetera. And I understand and totally respect what you're trying to do and the tough job that you have to balance both the marriage and the expenses. And if that works for you right now, that's great. I would take the next step, though, which is how do we grow closer and how do we eliminate the things that we actually argue about? Really, that's one of the ways that Dave Ramsey does a great job. Many financial advisors don't like Dave Ramsey that much. I happen to like him a lot and teach his class at least once a year. But because the seven baby steps take you through each one of these things. And the reason that you are married is you want to be together. So growing closer, if you can grow closer without causing more friction, then that will work for you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for...
Because of the spending, this has grown us closer because there's
great
conflict.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, and I think that that's something that's probably true across finance is that it's largely personal. You know, mm-hmm. if somebody finds something that works for them, that works for their family, great, you know, good. And sure. maybe they can read a little or find some other sure. solutions that, you know, would work even better or, you know, but I don't know. Is finance maybe largely a if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of thing?
Well, if it's working for you, Wayne, I think that's great. You found a solution. And, you know, I don't know that I want to change that.
Right. Amen.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about planning for retirement. So that's something that I think a lot of people, you know, are thinking about now, especially as we consider what will Social Security look like as we get older. You know, how is our country's population aging? I suppose that's one of those things you should probably be thinking about in your budget. You know, one of those things you might be thinking, well, hey, there's a priority for how I want to be saving is my retirement. But how do you think about that? What's one of the most important things for someone to consider when they're thinking about retirement?
Well, I think I'll go first, but I think the thing we talked about on the phone, Reagan, was that people need to put money into their IRA every year. No matter what else you have, you can always do that. It may not be deductible, or it may be, but it can be done, and it should be done. And I've had clients who will do things that I don't understand. They'll put a small amount into an IRA, into a 401k. And then complain they are not saving enough money or they're paying too much income tax. And when I tell them they can do that, they go, golly, no one told me.
Yeah. So I think what you were saying is that somebody should consider both a 401k and an IRA. It's not an either or decision.
Well, I think it can be either or, but it needs to be it's something you need to decide to do. If you want to save more than the maximum that a 401k will allow you to save, you can also contribute to an IRA. Mm-hmm. Or if you just want to contribute to an IRA, you can do that. Mm-hmm. I know when they first came out with IRAs, they said if you save $2,000 a year for 30 years at whatever the standard rate of income was back then or stated rate of return was back then, you'd have $1 million. Well, now you can save $5,500 a year. So theoretically, I guess you're going to have $3 million.
Yeah. What about you, Rick? What do you think people should be thinking about when they're trying to figure out how they want to save for retirement?
Well, there's an old adage that says, well begun, half done. And what it says, if you start a task correctly to begin with, you're going to have a much more likely positive outcomes when you get to it. So what I recommend with everyone, and it started with my daughters when they first got their first babysitting job, I said, okay, I want you to save 10% of what you've got for long-term savings, and I want you to understand that this is something I'm going to tell you to do year after year after year. So 10%. So when they got their first $10, they put, you know, $1 away into savings, and when they were young, it was a little piggy bank, or actually it was a little jar that was clear so they could see the money in it. As they get older, they've kept that habit, and what they've done is they've started to accumulate some money. Well, the vehicle begins to change, and actually, the most successful clients or the most successful people I know, the wealthiest people I know, have a personal savings rate of about 20%. If you go into the Asian community, you'll see that it's actually even higher. It's 25 and 30%. Many of these things are culturally determined because that's just the way they were brought up. My daughters were expected to save a little bit of money long term. So what I like to do is start at 10%, and that's a great place to start. It's a terrible place to finish. But once you establish the habit of it, everyone here who's listening, everyone at this table knows that once you get in the habit of saving that money for the first 3 months, all of a sudden you're just living on the money that you have left over. David could talk to you about the tax ramifications and how much if you save $10, you might only have to affect your budget by, $8.50 or maybe even only $8 is what you would end up spending. But the habit of beginning to do that, the systematic putting away money, is there's a great book out there for the listeners if they like it. It's called The Automatic Millionaire. And it talks about how do you save yourself or how do you set up systems that help you become wealthy to reach your goals. And I don't know anybody who can do it manually. I've met one client over the last 17 years who managed to accumulate $1 million in cash by saving it. And he owned a business, and there was a lot of other things that were going on there. But my thing is set it up automatically, start with 10%, and then you have an opportunity to grow each one. Set yourself another goal that says every year as I get a raise, say half my raise goes to increasing my regular savings. And what you'll end up having is, next thing you know, you'll be doing 20%, and you'll be one of those people who can look at their checking account, can look at their savings account, look at their emergency fund, look at their 401k, and they're all fully funded. And it seemed like it happened by magic. And, well, then when you have an emergency, it's not as big of an emergency. Automatic savings is a great way to go. Get yourself somebody who coaches you, somebody who gives you an accountability. Very often it shouldn't be your spouse, because one of the reasons you're married is you agreed on a lot of things. And if you want to make a big difference, you might have to find someone who can coach you towards a little bit more stretching of your goals. Mm-hmm. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. You know, no one's talked about this, but the power of compounding is your friend. Absolutely. Here, where you have interest on interest. You invest $1,000 for the first year at 10%. The next year, you have $1,000. You have $1,100, and then you're earning interest on $1,100 that year. And so you get interest on interest, and over the course of time, that's how you can have a small investment of a couple thousand dollars a month turn into $1 million 50 years from now. So the key, particularly for our young listeners, is to start early, because it's really hard to make up that difference when you start at 50. Mm-hmm. Or even 45. But if you start at 25, you know, you can get there a whole lot easier with a lot less money invested. Just do it regularly and early, and that will be your friend.
Mm-hmm. What about for people who maybe didn't start early, though? I mean, is there a point where you just say, oh, it's too late, you know? There's no point in starting now. I missed the boat.
Well, not if you like to eat.
No.
And if you like to live in a house that has air conditioning in Florida, you know, you can't just give up on that. You have to start where you are. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be more aggressive about it. You have to be more aggressive about controlling your spending, because that's where the money's going to come from. It's where you're sending it somewhere else now. It has to go to savings.
Great. We'll talk more about this after the break. Welcome back to Perspectives. Today we're talking about personal finance and financial literacy. If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so by calling us at 414-1234 or send us an email at perspectives@wfsu.org. So during the break, we got started on kind of an interesting conversation, I thought, about mortgages. And Rick, you were saying, I don't know exactly what you said, but you were advocating for a 15-year mortgage instead of a 30-year mortgage, because 30-year mortgages just don't tend to be a wise choice.
Well, Regan, it's not unusual that people don't remember what I said, but we'll try to remain that. The two things we were talking about was there's an acronym for called TINA, T-I-N-A, and that's for if you started late and you think, well, I should just give up now, and Matt said, well, not if you like to eat. Well, TINA stands for there is no alternative. So you need to keep doing it, whether you stick your head in the sand or not. You're just going to go ahead and start where you are and keep moving. You can't change what happened in the past. But the part that I really think that on personal finances, many people will try to buy the most house they can get. They've been told many, many times that that's the best investment that they'll ever have. And for many people, it is the largest. But what I recommend is that instead of doing a 30-year mortgage, do a 15-year mortgage. Because on an average $200,000 house, and that, I'm not doing this calculation right here, but my memory tells me that if you do a 15-year mortgage instead of a 30-year mortgage, you're going to save somewhere between $120,000, maybe $150,000 or $60,000. Well, people who do 15-year mortgages get them paid off. Think about if you were 25 and bought your first house, and 15 years, you're 40 years old, and the house is paid off. You've got a lot more money in your pocket now that you can invest or that you can contribute to lifestyle, instead of you got the most house that you could. The $200 or $300 a month difference in the payment is stretched out now over another 15 years. So instead of at 40, you're now 55. And you're at a point where, well, catching up is a lot harder. What I told you was that the axiom in the industry is 15-year mortgages get paid off, 30-year mortgages get refied.
That's right. That's right. What about, you know, does everybody need to own a home, though? For some people, might just sticking with a rental be the best long-term choice?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Too many people buy a house and then they move out of it in a year, year and a half, or 2 years. And that's a losing proposition. But general knowledge says, oh, you got to own a house, otherwise you're just throwing away rent money. I've got a client right now who's selling her house. Her husband passed away about 10 years ago, and she's ready to downsize a little bit. But because she's so used to having had it drilled into her head that she should own a house, well, that doesn't allow her to travel. She can't just pack up, close the house, or close the apartment and leave because she has a large house. And also, her husband passed away. There's less money in the budget and in the plan. So in many cases, it's wise to put off owning a home. When done properly, owning a home can be a huge wealth builder. And owning real estate in and of itself is an asset class that can be really well taken care of, very much leveraged into a lot. But I know David probably has done a lot more research on this when the dollars and cents come around. But there are tax advantages. But think about this. If you're going to get a 25% tax advantage on the money you put into a mortgage, or you could keep all that money, you'd get taxed on it, but you could keep that money, you wouldn't have to be, it would be 100% liquid. It would be a lot easier to move along. And I think the as an asset class, real estate is said to grow at about 6% a year. That's not a great asset class. It's just a great place to put the money where you're living.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that, David?
Well, my thoughts are that when interest rates got as low as they are right now, it has made the interest in owning property more lucrative than renting property. However, it hadn't stopped people in Tallahassee from building pretty nice apartment complexes, and there seems to be a lot of them because there's this perception that the younger generation is not interested in owning real estate. They are interested in having real nice place to live. And I think that that's more of a personal question overall.
Mm-hmm. I guess different things I've been told are, you know, that if you stop renting and you buy a home, it could be that the cost of your mortgage is actually going to be less than the cost of your renting. And so a lot of people say, oh, I'm going to save money by buying a house. It's a great idea. That's a good plan for me. But then there are a lot of things that you might not think about. Like, unless you can have a pretty sizable down payment, then you have to pay, like, mortgage insurance, I think it's called. And, you know, there are costs. If you're not going to live in this one place for a long time, if you're not pretty rooted there, there are a lot of costs involved with the, you know, on the selling end and the buying end of, you know, fees involved with that. And so what I've read is for some people, you know, it might make more sense to rent because of that, because that one part where they say, oh, well, your mortgage will be less than your rent is a little misleading, maybe.
Well, I think you also have to consider there's other costs involved in owning property. If you own your house, we have to pay somebody to cut the grass. We have to pay somebody to keep the pool clean. There seems to always be something that needs to be done. There's always something breaking. And we have the common concept that my wife is always wanting to get something new and different, better for the place.
Yeah.
Well, and there's also taxes and insurance, which is significant. It's a very significant part of owning a house. And you need to develop a budget before you purchase the house because there are a lot of hidden costs that you just don't think about and you don't know about. If you've never owned a house, you just lived at your parents' house, growing up, you didn't know that all these things happen. And then there's maintenance and upkeep. And the older the house, the more maintenance there is. And like David said, if you get in there and you decide, oh, I hate this carpet, I got to get this new carpet. And, you know, oh, I want to put some hardwood flooring here. Before long, you have eaten up, you've more than eaten up whatever savings there might have been. And then you get ready to relocate. If you're only there for a couple of years, you've got to pay a real estate commission to sell the house. More often than not, it's difficult to sell the house yourself. And then you've got to earn that. And then if you own two houses, like if you move to a place, take a job somewhere, you're there for 6 months and you're paying $1,000 there and $1,000 on your payment because the bank still expects you to keep paying it. Before long, that's $6,000. That ate up all your savings that you made by owning a house versus renting. So there's a lot more decisions involved than just simple. It's the mortgage is less than the rent.
So right. Going back to this, we do want we think it's good to own a house.
Yep.
I think it's great. It's great for couples. It's great for people. It can be a good investment. It's a wonderful place to live. It's an effective way to use your dollars when used correctly or when used properly. But anybody who's ever tried to take a screw out of the wall using a hammer knows that if you don't have the right tool or you don't use it the correct way, you're going to get less than optimal results.
And I would encourage from my experience as a pastor to buy less than you can afford. Don't buy only what you can afford. Don't listen to someone, whether it's a real estate agent or someone else, say, well, you know, you can qualify for $1,200 a month. We'll buy an $800 a month house. Mm-hmm. You know, find something that's not your dream home. Live in it. You know, do your research. Find a decent neighborhood, but buy something that's much less than you can afford, so you have margin built in. And then you can always move up if you choose to, but you're building equity while you're there, particularly if you got the 15-year mortgage. And it's a whole lot less stressful to know you can make that payment. And if there are two of you, it's better to take one income and decide we're going to make the house based on one income. That way it gives you a lot of options when you start having children, one of you decides to stay home. Yeah, it's a lot less stressful if you made all your mortgage decisions based on one income.
Mm-hmm. What about I think the idea of budgeting for a house is really interesting and figuring out how what your expenses would look like once you moved in. But also, I think budgeting for a down payment is something that people are thinking about. As I said, if you don't want to pay mortgage insurance, I think you have to have a 20% down payment. And I'm wondering, where should people, if somebody wants to start budgeting that, if that's a priority for them, is to move into a house sometime in the next, 10 years, where do they start saving that money? Like, I don't think that's something you'd put in your normal bank account. I think I read you can put it in an IRA. Is that not right? That you can?
Oh, you can, but you had some bad idea.
However, you can take up to $10,000 out of your IRA.
Right, the principal plus $10,000. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
I don't know what the principal.
I think it's
just $10,000.
Oh, not your. I guess your initial investment plus $10,000 is like up to $10,000.
No, just $10,000.
I am wrong. All right.
No, I bow to David's knowledge on this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and. And the idea of you should be aiming to if you sit down and do a budget and figure out what your goal is, you can determine what you need to do. And you're going to have to save some money in probably a regular savings account or something very similar to that, and use that to help you achieve having 20% to put down on the house. So you don't have to pay that mortgage insurance.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've read some about people who are looking for ways to save money more short term. So they don't want a long term savings account like you would have for your retirement fund, like an IRA,
right,
where that'll grow for you over a number of years. But they want something, you know, that they might be able to access in 10 years or 5 years, but that gets a higher interest rate than a typical bank account. You know, mm-hmm. Is there somewhere you recommend people go for that? Like, I've heard people talk about that in terms of a place to maybe put money that they want to save up for a down payment, or money mm-hmm. that maybe is their emergency fund where they could get quick access to it, but it's a big sum of money that they don't really intend to spend and that they'd like to see grow some.
Well, a lot of times guys are always trying to tinker with this. And, you know, if you shop the difference in the, you know, 0.1% on a CD at a different bank, you might be literally talking about differences in pennies per month at the current interest rates. So I understand the question is that we should we exercise our money a little bit more to get a little more money out or get a little more earnings out of it? One of the things we advocate, though, is you've got to have safe and you have to have liquid. Now, you can have a second tier, and that would be emergency fund. That's for the things you cannot, you can't predict. We know bad things will happen. We don't know what they'll be, but we know they're going to happen. You know, a friend of mine had a brick fall through the windshield of his car when he was up in Atlanta last week. That's something he had to pay for. So you need emergency money. Now, you can have a second tier that might be a little less liquid, and it might be a little less safe. But because it's a little less or more volatile, you can expect to get a greater rate, return, except for it's possible for that value to go down. So if you have to have some money in this bucket, the safe bucket, you make sure you fill that one up first. When that one is overflowing, then you can go to the next one. A place that you might do that is might use a money market. They're very low rates right now, too. So I might look for a municipal bond fund, something along those lines. But then there's a third tier is that you can actually go for a little more aggressive. But each one of these, you're spreading out the time period over which you might decide to use it. So it's that. It's like I like to say is that the blueprint is more important than the color of the walls. If you have the plan set out here where you know how you're going to build it, well, as soon as somebody finishes framing, they know that the next group of guys are going to come in. They're going to drill holes in places and put in the plumbing. Then the electrician's going to come in. So each one of them has a stepwise progression. But I really like to see people to make sure that they get that first thing, that emergency fund funded. Then what they do is that if they're out of debt, they have a lot less debt emergencies. Then they'll have maybe 3 to 6 months set up of expenses in case, in the case of a couple where one of them loses a job or something happens where they have to rely on their long-term savings. Then at that point, start building wealth. Many times we get in trouble when people try to become the kung fu master without learning how to stretch first.
Mm-hmm. What about, let's talk a little more about emergency funds. I think that's something that some people just, and I think a lot of the things we've been talking about maybe are things that seem a little unattainable to some people, right? We were saying, hey, you've got to save, you know, at least 10% of your income for retirement. And if that's all you're doing, man, you're going to have to start doing more than that soon. And now we're saying you've got to have an emergency fund and, you know, you got to start saving up for your down payment in your bank account so that you don't have to pay mortgage insurance. I think all of this sounds, you know, difficult for people who maybe are living paycheck to paycheck or who, you know, maybe they go, if I take 10% out of my paycheck here and I've looked at my budget, you know, I don't see how I can make my rent next month.
Right.
What do we do for people like that? What's the solution there?
Can I jump in on this?
Please do.
Okay. Well, the first thing is save something. Don't just, if you say, well, I can't do 10%, well, do 1%. Do 2%. What that does is that breaks the hold that money has over you in the battle that goes on between your ears. You got to save something. The second thing is get rid of some stuff. Almost all of us have some old cell phone sitting in a drawer somewhere. We got a bicycle that we never use anymore. You know, there's 4 or 5 things that just we don't use anymore, but we're hanging on to it because we've become blind to it. Sell some stuff. And then you have your, at least you have your emergency fund there. And the next time you get a flat tire, it's not as big of an emergency. So that's the first thing right there. Then realize how you are right now, it's called the bias of the present. How you are right now is not how you're always going to be. So we're maybe trying to plan for a better future. I'm fond of saying the people who are in their 20s and say, I'm not sure I can retire or I'm ever going to retire. And I say, well, it's a guarantee that someday you're going to be as old as me or you're going to be dead. So, you know, you're going to have to plan for that future. So everything is going to change. And it's amazing. Once you have that plan in place and you start to recognize those opportunities, you can take advantage of them. Start, sell some stuff. Have, you know, save 1%. Then the next thing is realize that the next job raise that you get, the next time you make a change, half of that raise is going to go towards improving your savings. What you have now is a blueprint and a plan to help take you to that spot. I'm very passionate about this. I like to I like to talk about it, so I'm going to shut up now.
Well, and I would also add to that that there are places that maybe you think you can't change that you could. You might could live in a different place. Mm-hmm. You might could drive a different vehicle. Like if you have a car payment on a car, you might be able to sell that car and buy a clunker and drive that for a year or two. And instead of paying the bank, you pay yourself. And, you know, you can downsize a lot of things and live like no one else for a while so you can live like no one else later, as Dave Ramsey says. You know, so you can – it's just choices. So don't feel like you're trapped in your current choices. Mm-hmm. Open the box up and don't try to create in such a small box. Put everything on the table. What can we do different here? You know, how can we do that? And unloading some stuff is a great idea. Just simplifying your life. You know, if you simplify it, and then you can decide, we can place this here and start where you are. You can't start where you're not. Like Rick said, you start where you are. And that's what we'd encourage people to do too as well.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for people, Matt, who are trying to build an emergency fund? You know, what sort of is a good rule of thumb for maybe what that should look like?
Well, it depends on where you are. You know, a young person, a young couple, $1,000, at least start there. Rick said, you know, let your goal be 3 to 6 months of your current expenses. If you know what your current expenses are, then you can know build toward that. But just start where you are. And then once you get your emergency fund, then start paying off debt. As you get debt paid off, you're going to have more and more to put in there.
Great. Well, thank you guys all for joining us today. I really appreciate your time here. It's been a great conversation.
It has been. It's been lovely.
Yes, yep. Thank you. Perspectives is produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance is provided by Evan Rossi with Lydell Rawls on the phones. And I'm Regan McCarthy.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media. Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.